Part 6. Production and Quality.
Chapter 23. Production Preparation. The last moment you're actually in control. Welcome back. So, in Part 5, you got your golden sample approved. It took longer than expected, probably required more revision rounds than anyone budgeted for, and somewhere around the second or third iteration, you started to understand why people call it the golden sample and not the fast sample. But here you are. And here's where it gets real. Everything up to this point, the product idea, the spec, the supplier search, the sample iterations, all of that was preparation. Reversible, correctable, cheap to fix. The moment you sign off on a production run, that window closes. What you approve now gets manufactured, at volume. And mistakes at volume have a very different price tag than mistakes on a sample. So let's talk about what actually needs to be locked in before the factory starts a single machine. Most people think production preparation means tell the factory to go ahead. It does not. It means confirming in writing that every element of the product is fully defined and documented. Dimensions, materials, tolerances, colors, functions, all of it. Plus the approved golden sample as the physical benchmark. Plus packaging specs, label positioning, accessory contents, barcode placement. Without all of that in place, a production approval isn't a starting gun. It's a bet that things will somehow work out. And bets in manufacturing pay out less often than people hope. Here's a piece that gets almost no attention. Beyond your visible specs, there's a second layer running inside the factory that you can barely see. Production parameters. Machine selection, sequence of manufacturing steps, drying times, coating processes, assembly procedures. None of this appears in your brief. It lives in the factory's internal know-how. Why does it matter? Because these invisible parameters determine whether your product comes out consistently run after run, or whether a second order looks mysteriously different from the first, even though the brief is identical.
Here's a real example that sticks. Imagine a stainless steel water bottle with a matte black powder coat. First order. Runs on the newer coating line. Drying time observed precisely. Result is flawless. Second order. That line is occupied. The factory switches to an older one. Spray heads calibrated differently. Coating thickness varies slightly. And the drying time gets shortened 20 minutes because the next job is pressing. The bottle looks identical at first glance, but after 3 weeks in the backpack, abrasion marks. The spec was the same sheet of paper both times. The process behind it was not. Full control over internal production parameters is unrealistic, but you can ask the right questions before the series starts. Which machines will be used? Are they the same ones used during the pre-production sample? Are there manual steps where the result depends on the operator? What drying or curing times are defined? Asking these questions doesn't always produce complete answers, but it signals that process consistency is expected, and that alone shifts attention inside the factory. Now, packaging. The topic everyone waves off as a detail, until it creates a problem at scale. Label positioning. Exact, not approximate, including distance from the edge. Packaging sequence. Which element goes in the bag first? Which inserts go where? Carton protection. Cushioning. Dividers. Film thickness. Master carton specification. Dimensions. Gross weight. Units per carton. Stackability. All of this must be unambiguously defined before production starts. Changes during or after production almost always mean extra costs, delays, or problems at the border. The product doesn't end at manufacturing. It ends when it's sitting on the shelf, ready to sell. And everything that sits between manufactured and shelf-ready needs a spec. Bottom line for this chapter. Production preparation is the last moment real control can be exercised. Everything that isn't defined now gets decided inside the factory according to their logic, their time pressure, their cost constraints. Not your intent, theirs. People who work carefully here build the foundation for reproducible results. People who rush it shift their problems into a phase where fixing them is expensive and partial at best. And that's not where you want to learn that lesson.
Chapter 24. Packaging, labeling, and the logistical reality nobody warns you about.
All right, let's stay with packaging for a moment, because I want to give this topic the airtime it deserves, which is considerably more than most importers give it. Here's the classic pattern. An importer spends weeks obsessing over the product, gets the spec tight, approves the golden sample, negotiates the price, then treats packaging like an administrative formality. A few days before production wraps, they fire off a message with a logo file and a color code and assume the factory handles the rest. And then the first customer opens the box. Let me walk you through what actually needs to be locked down before production starts. Not during, before. Because changes after production starts almost always generate extra costs, delays, or both. Label positioning. This sounds obvious. It is not. Every label on your product needs an exact placement spec. Care instructions, barcodes, warning labels, CE marking if your product requires it, country of origin statements, not somewhere on the back, not approximately centered. Exact, including the distance from the edge. Inconsistent label placement creates problems at customs, at Amazon FBA intake, and with end customers who notice when the barcode is crooked. And they do notice. Packaging sequence. Which element goes into the bag first? How the item is folded? Which inserts go where? In what order? Sounds absurdly granular, right? In practice, this is a recurring source of complaints. Assemblies that fall apart in transit. Inserts that shift and scratch the product. Accessories lose at the bottom of the box. Packaging sequence is a spec, not a suggestion. Protection inside the carton. Cushioning, dividers, film thickness. What arrives undamaged as a single sample can look very different when 500 units are stacked in a master carton and loaded onto a ship that crosses an ocean. Sample conditions and shipping conditions are not the same environment. Master carton specification. Dimensions, gross weight, units per carton, stackability. These numbers directly affect your freight costs and must be coordinated with your freight forwarder before production runs. A carton that's 1 centimeter too tall can change your pallet count. An overweight carton can trigger surcharges you didn't budget for. And none of this is recoverable after the goods are already packed. And the bill of materials. Every item that belongs in the packaging needs to appear on a final packing list. Accessories, spare parts, instructions, warranty cards, anything. If it's missing from the list, it might be missing from the box. At scale, the book covers the full packing list structure in detail. What goes on it, how it connects to the commercial invoice, and why your freight forwarder needs it before they book anything. Worth reading closely. And shipping marks. Every master carton needs specific information printed on it. Item number, quantity, gross and net weight, carton number, importer name and address. Missing or incorrect information means goods can't be assigned in the warehouse, shipments get missorted by the freight forwarder, or entire deliveries get rejected at Amazon FBA. What is printed on the carton must be defined before production starts, not assumed. Defined. Here's the line I want you to carry out of this chapter. Packaging isn't the final step after manufacturing. It's part of manufacturing. It needs the same level of specification, the same documentation discipline, and the same sign-off process as the product itself. Treat it as an afterthought, and you pay for it. Usually twice. Once to fix it, once in the time it costs you. Chapter 25. Scheduling and stability. Why ideal timelines are not planning. Let's talk about time. Specifically, the way most importers think about production timelines versus the way production actually runs. The standard approach? Factory says 8 weeks. You write 8 weeks in your project plan. You mark a delivery date. You might even tell someone about it. And then week 9 arrives. A production schedule is not a static number you receive from the factory and simply adopt as fact. It is a dynamic framework that must reflect the reality of manufacturing. And the reality of manufacturing includes material availability, internal capacity, queries, production adjustments, factory holidays, power outages, raw material shortages, and other orders with higher priority that, conveniently, nobody told you about. Planning from ideal conditions means planning for a world that doesn't exist. The market doesn't run on ideal conditions. Your factory doesn't either. Realistic planning has 3 elements, and they are all unglamorous. First, buffers. At minimum 10 to 15% of the stated production time held back as a reserve. Not because you expect everything to go wrong, because things rarely go exactly to plan. A buffer isn't pessimism, it's math. The math of how often 8 weeks actually means 9. Second, checkpoints. Defined moments during production when you actively review progress. Not only at the end, when the container has already been booked and your options have gone from fix it to accept it or don't. Useful checkpoints land after material receipt, after the first third of production, and before packaging begins. If something has gone sideways, those are the moments you find out while you can still do something about it. Third, escalation scenarios. What happens if the schedule slips by 1 week, by two? Who gets notified? What options exist? What costs arise? Thinking through these scenarios before production starts is not pessimism. It is risk management. The difference between someone who planned for a delay and someone who didn't is not the delay. It's how expensive the surprise turns out to be. And now the one people really don't want to hear. The danger of last-minute changes. You know that feeling. Production is about to start, and then someone notices a detail. A color that could be slightly different. A feature that a customer requested. A small improvement that just seems obvious. The impulse is completely understandable. The risk is not small. Short-notice changes just before or during a production run are one of the biggest risk factors in the entire import process. Here's why. A color change on one component sounds harmless, but it may affect the packaging, the product photography, the item description, and the existing listing on your sales channel. A change in material thickness alters the weight per unit, and therefore the gross weight per master carton, and therefore your freight costs. Every change has downstream effects. And the closer you are to the production start, the less time remains to map those effects cleanly. The rule in this phase is simple, even if it's uncomfortable. Stability matters more than perfection. If a change is not safety critical or contractually mandatory, it belongs in the next order, not this one. Last-minute optimizations feel like progress. In practice, they are the most reliable cause of chaos in an otherwise clean production run. Bottom line, time pressure is the most reliable catalyst for quality problems in manufacturing. Those who plan too tightly lose room to maneuver. And under pressure, the fastest solution gets chosen, not the best one. Build in the buffer. Agree on the checkpoints. Think through the scenarios. It's the least exciting advice in this whole part, and consistently one of the most expensive pieces to ignore.
Chapter 26. Production workflow and monitoring. Staying on top of the run. So, production has started, the factory is running, and here's where a lot of importers quietly disappear. The logic being, we approved the golden sample, we gave clear instructions, the factory knows what to do. Now we wait. Production without monitoring means errors only become visible once they've been fully executed, across the entire quantity, in every batch, in every carton. What could have been noticed in the first 100 units and corrected with minimal effort travels undetected through the entire series. Individuals who only check at the end aren't controlling production, they are documenting what already went wrong. Let's get into what actually happens during a production run. Manufacturing typically runs in batches, each going through the same processes, but under real conditions, not laboratory conditions. Material batches vary slightly, machine states drift, tool wear accumulates, temperature, humidity, shift changes in personnel. All of these cause results to vary between batches in ways that only become visible to the end customer through returns, negative reviews, and complaints nobody can explain. This is exactly where it becomes clear whether your golden sample represented a truly reproducible product or one of produced under optimal conditions that morning. A factory won't always tell you which one it was. So what does actual monitoring look like? It starts as soon as production is underway. First units come off the line. Spot checks them against the golden sample. After a third of the total quantity, another round. Before packaging begins, another look. The rationale is simple. The earlier a defect is caught, the smaller the damage. A deviation in the first units can be corrected. The same deviation at the end affects the entire batch. In practice, this kind of monitoring is called an inline inspection or mid-production inspection. Units are pulled directly from the running line, compared against the golden sample and checked for deviations. The decisive advantage over a final inspection only, inline inspections enable immediate response. Processes can be adjusted, machine settings corrected, materials reviewed. This is not passive observation, this is active steering. And what specifically do you check? Not everything. Targeting matters. Material use. Are the approved materials actually being used, or has there been a quiet substitution?
workmanship, seams, adhesive joints, connection points, surface quality, directly against the golden sample, dimensions and function, key measurements per your spec sheet, visual quality, color consistency, surface finish, print quality across batches, not just within a single batch, packaging and labeling, correct execution of labels, barcodes, inserts and carton contents, all of it measured against the approved reference. Without a golden sample on site, every assessment is subjective. With one, it becomes objective, traceable and defensible. Now, in most cases, this monitoring isn't done by the buyer directly. It's handled by someone on the ground, a sourcing agency, a buying office, or an in-country quality partner. The advantage is proximity. Problems get addressed directly, without losing days to multi-step communication across time zones. An independent set of eyes matters here. The factory rarely proactively reports its own mistakes. An independent party spots them anyway. And here's the piece people chronically underestimate. Active follow-up during production. Even when production spans only a few weeks, it doesn't automatically become your factory's top priority. Factories run multiple orders in parallel. Their internal prioritization is not determined by your delivery date. It's determined by perceived urgency, capacity utilization, and relationship. Which means you need to actively track status. Has production been scheduled? Have all materials arrived? Is manufacturing running as planned? Or are there shifts? Without this active follow-up, the impression forms that your project isn't time sensitive. Other orders slide ahead. Your production slides back, often without clear communication about it. This isn't checking in, this is steering. And the difference shows in whether your delivery date holds or has to be explained afterward. There's one more piece. Monitoring only works if findings move fast.
An inspection whose results sit in someone's inbox for 3 days is worthless. Production continues during that time, even though the problem is already known.
Defined points of contact, agreed response times, clear escalation path, not glamorous, genuinely essential. Bottom line, early inspections, clear references, active follow-up, and a functioning communication structure. That's not overhead. That's the difference between a managed process and one where you can only react at the end. People who take production monitoring seriously catch problems while they can still be corrected. Those who skip it see the result, and the result is rarely better than the process behind it.
Chapter 27, Quality Control. What you define in advance determines what you can enforce later. Last chapter of part 6, and I saved the most structured one for the end. Here's a pattern that plays out with almost comical regularity in this business. Production runs. Goods are finished. Container is almost ready to load. And then someone thinks, when exactly are we doing QC? At that point, your options have shrunk considerably, your negotiating position is weak, and you're essentially asking the factory if they'd be so kind as to allow you to inspect goods they're about to ship. That conversation goes better when you have leverage. Leverage you hold before the goods are packed. QC must be defined before production starts. Not as an optional appendix that gets scheduled later, but as an integral part of the production plan, with defined criteria, defined timing, and defined consequences. An appendix is the first thing to get cut when things get tight. Let's build the system. There are 4 inspection types, each addressing a different risk, and together they cover the full production process. The first is the PPI, pre-production inspection. This happens before the first unit is produced. Materials, components, packaging, and production plans are checked before machines even start. That sounds unspectacular. It's one of the most effective levers in the entire process. Many problems aren't created in production. They're built in beforehand. Wrong material, imprecise specs, misunderstood instructions. Catching this here costs a few hours. Overlooking it drags the problem through thousands of units. Those who skip this step save time and buy themselves a problem that scales beautifully. Second, the DPI, during production inspection. This takes place when roughly 20-30% of the quantity has been produced. If a defect is identified now, machines can be recalibrated, processes corrected, materials reviewed. If the same defect only surfaces at the end, it affects the entire shipment. The difference is not technical, it's financial. Third, the PSI, pre-shipment inspection. This is the most well-known form of QC and the one that carries the most weight. It takes place when production is complete and the goods are mostly packaged. Based on the AQL method, more on that in a moment, samples are drawn and evaluated and the final decision is made, accept or reject.
The PSI is not a corrective measure, it is a decision-making measure. What comes to light here can no longer be elegantly fixed. And this is exactly why the PSI is tied directly to payment. In most cases, a 30-70 structure applies. 30% deposit before production, the remaining 70% only after a past PSI. That's not coincidence, it's a mechanism. Those who pay before the PSI lose their leverage. Those who pay only after hold the factory accountable until the end. And fourth, the CLC, container loading check. The step many skip because the product is already finished and inspected, which is exactly what makes it dangerous. At this point, the question is no longer product quality in detail, it's completeness. Is the quantity correct? Assignment, is the right product in the right container? Transport safety, is the packaging intact? Is the loading secure? Errors here have nothing to do with manufacturing, they're pure execution. Wrong items, missing quantities, damaged packaging. Equally frustrating, harder to explain. Now, let's talk about the AQL method, because this is where QC stops being an opinion and starts being a standard. AQL stands for Acceptable Quality Level. It's a standardized, internationally recognized system for quality assessment based on sampling. Instead of checking every single unit, which is neither economical nor accurate, a defined proportion of the production is inspected. On that basis, a decision is made: accept or reject the entire shipment. This is not a proprietary system invented by importers. ISO 2859 ANSI/ASQZ 1.4, used by Walmart, Apple, IKEA, the pharmaceutical industry. It is the common denominator of professional manufacturing quality control, globally. If a supplier doesn't know what to do with AQL terminology, that is not a detail problem. It's a clear warning sign. Either basic quality understanding is missing or the willingness to work to internationally accepted standards. Both are problematic. At that point, it's worth asking very seriously whether production should happen there at all. How does it work? Three steps, always the same sequence. First, from the order quantity and the chosen inspection level, typically general inspection level 2 for standard consumer goods, a code letter is derived from the first AQL table. That code letter determines the depth of the inspection. Second, the code letter goes into the second table, which gives you the concrete sample size and the accept and reject thresholds for each defect class. Third, you inspect that sample against your golden sample, classify every deviation and compare against the thresholds. The decision comes directly from the numbers. And defects are not all equal. Three classes: critical defects, AQL 0.0, safety risks, legal violations, fundamental product failures. Accept 0, reject 1. A single critical defect in the sample fails the entire shipment, no exceptions. Major defects, AQL 2.5, functional impairments, things clearly unacceptable to the customer. In a typical example, with a sample of 125 units, up to 7 major defects are accepted. 8 fails the shipment. Minor defects, AQL 4.0. Cosmetic, doesn't affect function. A slightly uneven color, a minimal logo offset. Higher tolerance, still tracked. The system prioritizes with crystal clarity. A scratch on a bottle and the lid that detaches under pressure with hot tea inside are not the same problem. AQL doesn't treat them as such. Neither should you. One more thing before we close. What happens when an inspection fails? The QC report is a finding, not a negotiation. The inspector checked and documented. They are not deciding commercial terms. That's your job. And the solutions depend on the situation. Rework, technically sound, but always followed by a second inspection, because manual intervention reliably creates new deviations. Price reduction or compensation across future orders. The most common outcome in practice, structured across follow-on orders to keep the relationship intact. Exchange or full rejection. For severe defects, the cleanest solution, but also the most disruptive in terms of time. And behind all of it, as a last resort, Alibaba Trade Assurance as a dispute mechanism. Worth knowing it exists, not worth needing it regularly. Winning a dispute and losing a supplier is not a success, it's plan B. Here's the line that holds this whole chapter together. QC without predefined criteria is an exchange of opinions. With defined criteria, it is a tool.
cool. The difference between those two things is not technical, it's economic. The book goes deep on all of this, the full AQL tables, how code letters map to sample sizes, the exact accept and reject thresholds by defect class, and how to structure the conversation after an inspection fails. It's one of the more detailed sections and worth reading slowly. This is the framework, the book is the workbench. And with that, the production run is done. Your goods are inspected, approved, and moving, which means you're about to face an entirely different kind of challenge. In part 7, we get into law and regulation. The EU, the USA, CE marking, the general product safety regulation, labeling requirements, liability, the part that quietly determines whether a product you've spent months developing can actually be sold in your target market. Because ready to ship and legal to sell are not always the same thing, not even close. See you in part 7.